Will the chambers come to order? In accordance with the uniform rules, Rules 51, during a joint session, the presiding officer is the President of the Senate. At this time, I turn the gavel over to the President.
Would like to call the joint session to order. The purpose of today's joint session is to hear an address from United States Senator Frank Murkowski. Senator Halford.
Madam President, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and that all members of the Senate be shown as present.
Without objection, the roll call of the Senate will be waived and all members of the Senate will be shown as present. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam President. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House also be waived and that all members be shown as present.
Hearing no objections, the roll call of the House has been waived and all members will be shown as present. I would at this time like to ask Senator Lloyd Jones and Representative Pat Porchot to escort Senator Murkowski to the House chambers, please. With a great deal of pleasure that I present to members of the Alaska State Senate and members of the Alaska State House of Representatives, United States Senator Frank Murkowski.
Thank you. Chair, all right? They have in Washington now speech boxes. They're supposed to work, but they don't, so we'll just put that aside. Madam President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Alaska State Legislature, I'm very pleased to be here today. I'll take the responsibility for the lovely weather. You know, I think this is my sixth time that I've had the privilege of addressing the assembled Alaska State Legislature. I think it's been on Valentine's Day on a few occasions. This is the first time it's been on Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th started rather early for me, about 12:01 this morning, when Southeast basketball group moved into the hotel room next to mine and proceeded to relive the event. So I got an early start. I can't help but editorialize a little bit on the fact that the Irish appear to be moving down to Juneau, and one of Anchorage's more noted Irishmen will be frequenting these halls. That's, as we say in Washington, a rather extraordinary event. I certainly appreciate being with you each year. You know, our jobs and responsibilities may be different, but our overall objective is a common one, and that's to do what is best for Alaska, and that's why I particularly value this opportunity to share with you. During the campaign season, of course, we all emphasize bright tomorrows and great optimism about Alaska's future. That's what you're really expected to do in a campaign, but afterward, after the election, we really confront reality. And the economic reality for Alaska today certainly is not as bright as we would wish it to be. Our economy is clearly in a slump, and things are going to get tougher, and we're aware of that. But we Alaskans have seen tough times before, and we've always emerged a little stronger, and I think we can do that this time. But I do have to share with you that it is upsetting from time to time to hear some of the words being used to describe our current economic situation. People are calling it a crisis, a disaster, and various other words of doom. You know, I can remember, as some of you can, real disasters in Alaska 20 years ago this year. I see Red nodding his head, so I must be right on my arithmetic. The banks of the Chena overflowed, wiping out Fairbanks and causing nearly $100 million in damage. On Good Friday in 1964, when the earthquake devastated Anchorage, Kodiak, Valdez, Seward, and other communities, there was a tragic loss of life and billions of dollars worth of damage. Those were real disasters. I can also remember how Alaskans reacted in the face of those crises. We rolled up our sleeves and we went to work, and everybody pitched in without regard to regionalism, without regard to partisanship. And Alaskans did it for Alaskans. We were a team, and that spirit of teamwork, that action, led us to brighter days, days which saw the settlement of the land claims, construction of the pipeline, economic prosperity, and really some good times. We face that similar challenge today, and one big challenge that I would like to discuss with you this morning involves the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, more commonly known as ANWR. The issue is rather simple. Should Congress permit oil exploration in a small portion of ANWR, the 1.5 million acre coastal plain of the 18 million acre refuge? My answer is an emphatic yes. And I'm not alone. Polls show that better than 70% of Alaskans say yes as well. And most, I think, if not all of you, would agree. But I must tell you very candidly that as of today, we do not have the support in Congress to open ANWR. That's why I was very pleased to learn of you, the legislators' support of our governor's request for funds to lobby the ANWR effort nationally. To be successful, however, it is going to require a very, very professional effort. I think Alaskans can win this fight, but only if we work as a team. It is essential that we present a unified front and speak with one voice to the Congress of the United States. We're going to need clear policy statements from you, the legislature, as well as our governor. I think even as we agree that our primary objective is to open the coastal plain to oil and gas exploration, there are several related and sensitive issues which are obscuring perhaps our common goal. These include the land exchanges and the 90-10 revenue sharing. I'm aware of the substantial concern here at home over the issue of land exchanges in ANWR, and I share your concern that these proposed exchanges will not embrace any particular land exchange unless it's in the state's best interest and unless it will help us achieve the main objective of opening ANWR. There are a number of misconceptions about these proposed exchanges, including the perception that the entire 1.5 million acre coastal plain will be traded away. Well, that's simply not true. Even if all the land trades now on the table were made, more than 85% of the plain would still be untouched. Much of the concern about land swaps is based on the assumption that native corporations will acquire resources that the state now has a 90% interest in, and that the state will receive nothing in return. This is really another misconception about the land exchanges. There are several ways that the state can benefit from the swaps. As you know, the state is now and has been negotiating with the Department of Interior to swap state-owned land for subsurface resources in Anwar. The state owns in-holdings in National Wildlife Refuge that the Department of Interior would desperately like to acquire. By trading those in-holdings, the state can assure itself of 100% interest in potentially oil-bearing lands in Anwar. In other words, we can actually own part of Anwar like we own Prudhoe Bay. In addition, we may want to explore an arrangement where the state would retain an undivided interest or an overriding royalty share in all tracts traded to private corporations. Either of these approaches would guarantee revenues for the state if any oil is discovered. Some of you may ask, well, why pursue any swaps at all, particularly if the state has to become involved in a rather complicated process to ensure adequate compensation? Well, the answer involves several features. The exchanges can provide distinct advantages and benefits to the state, and they can give the congressional delegation tactical advantages in achieving our main goal, that of opening Anwar. Let me talk very briefly about some legislative tactics. There is little doubt that the land swaps will encourage more groups to commit their resources towards opening the coastal plain, resources that can increase public awareness and garner more congressional support. And that's important because our strongest opponent is a coalition of national environmental groups with massive national fundraising capability. And make no mistake about it, these groups will pull out all stops to prevent oil exploration and development in Anwar. Anwar will become the environmental battle of this decade. You know, if you reflect back, you'd note that environmental groups in Alaska and nationally have opposed every single major development in our state in the last 20 years. We can expect well-financed emotional appeals that are designed to convince Americans that we must make a choice between oil and caribou. They would have you believe that it's that simple. The New York Times, the day before yesterday, had its first guest editorial against Anwar by George Frampton Jr., president of the Wilderness Society. This group, of course, also opposed the Trans-Alaska Pipeline very vehemently. Now, let me show you something that I think is most interesting. The brochures have already begun to fill mailboxes in the lower 48, and these are the brochures. They're going out all over the country. They're very slick, very well done, and they make the emotional appeal that the issue is simply one of oil or caribou. Brochures from the same group, you might recall, showed photos of Mount McKinley and the California redwoods in the Tongass. I hope some of you remember that. I'm sure Lloyd Jones does. Propaganda that fails to mention that we are talking about opening up only 1.5 million acres of an 18 million acre refuge that already has 8 million acres of designated wilderness. They don't say that story. 8 million acres is a lot of wilderness. 9 states altogether, including Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Maryland, Rhode Island, and Vermont, total that approximate acreage. Environmentalists also don't mention that Prudhoe Bay, the experience that we've had there, has shown that the caribou and reasonable development can coexist. The Department of Interior study on the herd, on the Prudhoe Bay herd, indicates that the herd in 1972 was about 3,000 animals and is in excess of 14,000 today. We're seeing even our Canadian neighbors becoming alarmed by the environmental smokescreen. Yesterday, when I was in Los Angeles, I had an opportunity to be interviewed by CBC. I was really astounded to learn that allegedly, as far as Canada was concerned, it was a case again of sacrificing the porcupine caribou herd for oil. Now, keep in mind that land exchanges can also help us to cope with those in Congress who want to consolidate federal refuge lands. The acquisition of privately owned inholdings is a priority for some of the major environmental organizations and for the Fish and Wildlife Service. The prospects that the inholdings may be acquired through exchanges of subsurface rights in ANWR may have a positive influence on these groups and their allies in Congress as well. I believe many of my colleagues will be able to justify opening ANWR to development, provided they can tell their constituents that the environmentalists basically got something out of the deal, like diverting some federal ANWR revenues to the purchase of additional refuge lands in the lower 48, or eliminating inholdings in other Alaska refuges through the land exchanges. Now, those are a few of the short-term, perhaps tactical, political benefits of land exchanges. Now, if you bear with me, let's look at some of the long-term economic benefits. Privately owned oil wells will be subject to three types of taxes, at least: the severance taxes, property taxes, corporate income taxes. If oil is discovered, the state revenue generated by these taxes could be substantial. In addition, we can expect that the activity on native-owned ANWR lands will create jobs for resident Alaskans who spend their wages within our state. And finally, the development of privately held resources should occur much faster than development of resources owned by the federal or state government. We should all recognize the advantage of the quickest possible exploration of some of the prospects in ANWR. To me, the best way to assess the land exchanges is to add up all the potential benefits, the long-term economic gains, political and tactical advantages which I've outlined, and 100% state-owned ANWR tracts and a possible interest in private tracts as well. Now, if land exchanges are good for Alaska, then we may want to use them to help open up ANWR. We shouldn't just dismiss them out of hand. Because the state is now sitting at the negotiating table with the Department of Interior, the state is in a position to access the exchanges and maximize the benefits Alaska would receive. I'll certainly continue to do everything I can to see that the state remains a central player in the negotiating process. Again, let me share with you our primary objective: to pass legislation that permits oil exploration on the coastal plain of ANWR. Now, I know that many of you strongly oppose any effort to reduce Alaska's 90-10 share of revenue. And I can understand that, and I intend to fight for the 90-10 split. But we are going to have some flexibility. I'm finding it very difficult to talk to members from other states without being asked, why should I support opening ANWR when Alaska will receive 90% of the royalties? That's just the way it comes across. The point is, there are definite advantages to be gained in the political process by having 90-10 on the bargaining table going in. Before we fall on our sword on 90-10, let's ask ourselves a simple question. Would we rather have 90% of nothing or a lesser percent of something? Everyone in this chamber understands negotiation. You know that passing legislation requires some flexibility. And I pledge to you that we will work closely with this body and the governor. We will seek your counsel and opinions as we move forward. And I think when Alaskans work together, we can make things happen. And we have achieved it, certainly, in other areas. Let me share with you briefly action in the Pacific Rim. 2 weeks ago, I had the pleasure of announcing the first shipment of Cook Inlet oil, which is going to Korea. Well, today it's gone. It's a reality. We know that our state royalty oil will soon be moving to Taiwan. And these are really exciting developments because they're milestones. We cut through some of the red tape that's prohibited our economic growth previously. We're really opening the door. We've taken a step that puts another Alaska commodity into the markets of the world. We have other opportunities as well, and today we're seeing the development of Alaska as a central hub for international air cargo. It's beginning to develop rather rapidly. That's a natural extension of the work that's begun several years ago to get international carrier landing rights in Alaska. And our tourism potential has the capability to take a very, very tremendous leap because of the visa waiver provisions we were able to include in the immigration bill that passed in the last Congress. For the first time, as many as perhaps 400,000 of the 1.5 million international passengers who fly through Alaska each year will be able to visit our state without going through the time-consuming process of getting a visa at a U.S. consulate overseas. In addition to tourism, international trade is another area that I'm concentrating on in this Congress. Just the last few days in Los Angeles, I had an opportunity to share a trade hearing with Senator Cranston on competitiveness and trade with the Pacific Rim. This is the area in which I've chosen my committee assignments, namely the Foreign Relations Committee and the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, to promote Alaska's resources in the Pacific Rim, the greatest market potential in the world. As a consequence of my membership on the Foreign Relations Committee, it puts me in a position to negotiate directly with leaders of the Pacific Rim nations and push for market access for Alaska's resources. In the last Congress, some of you will recall that we were able to include provisions in the South African Sanction Act that opened the door to new opportunities for Alaska's strategic minerals. We need not rely on South Africa. Alaska has produced chromium, tin, silver, lead, zinc, copper, mercury. We now have the opportunity to become competitive again. My committee chairmanship also ensures Alaska a strong voice in the development of new trade legislation. I'm going to be introducing shortly legislation to establish tariffs on imported surimi equal to that which Japan applies to the U.S.-produced surimi. Alaska producers must have the same market access that Japanese surimi has. I would hope Japan would see fit to cancel their import quota as a consequence of this, and I have reason to believe that will happen. We're also taking an intense interest in efforts to reduce high sea interception of Alaska salmon. And we've initiated contacts to open negotiations with the Soviet Union aimed at opening up their exclusive economic zone to our crab fishermen. There are a number of things we're doing on the federal level, but I would share with you an observation that much more has to be done at home to emphasize the commitment to Alaska's exports. I would suggest to you that we lack as a state a comprehensive export strategy, one which clearly states what the state wants to export and what steps we intend to take to make it happen as a matter of policy, as a matter of priority. You know, are our priorities to expand petrochemical production, to expand timber and coal production, to market our natural gas reserves by building a pipeline to Tidewater, export our North Slope oil, our fisheries products? Are we ready to adopt policies that some states have seen fit to do to provide economic incentives for development, to positively encourage rather than discourage economic development and jobs? We're going to have to work together to create a climate that encourages individuals and companies to take the risk of investing in our state. We have all kinds of agencies that are responsible for regulating resource development and exports, but who in government has the responsibility of cutting the red tape and promoting new exports, of really making things happen? Let me share with you for a moment the coal mine being developed at Beluga, or hopefully will be developed at Beluga, a planned world-class mine capable of producing steam coal at competitive prices. And competitive prices are prices with Australia and prices with South Africa. We in the delegation have actively promoted steam coal exports to Pacific Rim nations. And we've seen that development with the use of belly contracts to Korea, and now the likelihood that some of that coal is going to move to Taiwan. We've met with the decision makers in Taiwan, Korea, Japan. I have the opportunity, as a consequence of my position on the Foreign Relations Committee and ranking on Pacific and East Asian affairs. And our governor, as did his predecessors, publicly announced that coal export is a priority for Alaska. And many of you have done likewise. Yet right now, the developer of the mine at Beluga can't get the state permits to proceed. There's potentially 600 jobs, substantial economic activity hanging in the balance. One problem, and it's not just this simple, and I recognize that, but one problem involves reclamation policy that will not allow mixing of topsoil and subsoil after mining. State law appears to require any substitute material to be of a quality equal to or better than topsoil. And it sounds like the old placer miners and the case on water quality all over again. You begin to wonder if we can really get there from here. And I share that because that's the frustration that comes to me from the people who are trying to make these things happen. We've perhaps put one barrier after another, discouraging rather than encouraging development. In this instance, I'm told after a two-year process, the application for permits fill 26 volumes weighing some 400 pounds and taking up about 10 feet of shelf space. Unfortunately, but I think it's true, it's pretty obvious that only large multinationals need apply to develop Alaska's resources. The little guy really doesn't stand a chance. I think you'd share with me that that's too bad. Coal mine at Beluga is perhaps one example. There are others facing similar obstacles as well. On both the state and the federal level, it's critical that we continue to review the regulatory process, removing redundant requirements which increase the competitive price and inhibit the export of our resource. And I believe that we can do this while maintaining adequate environmental safeguards that ensure our air and water are of the highest quality and that our special Alaska lifestyle is maintained. Of course, economic potential need not necessarily depend on resource development. I think you'd agree we're making other significant federal contributions to Alaska's economic outlook. And federal spending, military spending, is certainly one of them. You know, Alaska benefits from more than $1 billion federal dollars in the economic mainstream each year as a result of a number of things that are prioritized and significant: the Light Infantry Division, the F-15s, the AWAC, the KC-135s, the A-10s, military payroll, locally awarded military contracts, roughly $100 million in new military construction will take place in our state this year as a consequence of the new Light Infantry Division. And it's anticipated that another $100 million will follow next year. And next year, we hope to begin the first significant construction of a $450 million backscatter radar. And when I relate to figures, I recall the pulp mill when it went into Ketchikan in 1952. The cost of that was about $52 million. That doesn't mean anything, and inflation's inflation, but it gives you some reference. That's a lot of money going into our state and into our economy. This kind of federal investment in Alaska is helping our economic situation, and we will continue to pursue these initiatives, not only because they help Alaska, but because they're in the national interest. Now, finally, I'd like to discuss with you a matter of particular interest to many Alaskans, and the issue is one of drug and alcohol abuse. Nancy and I have visited many Alaska communities over the years, and we've seen firsthand the tremendous anger, the tremendous frustration and heartache over drug and alcohol abuse, particularly in Alaska's small bush communities. I think you'd agree that Alaskans are becoming increasingly aware that our children are daily being placed in danger by casual drug and alcohol abuse. Alaska's per capita consumption of drugs is above the national average, and that's a tragedy. Congress passed a major drug bill last year that will provide block grants to Alaska totaling almost $2 million to assist local law enforcement, provide rehabilitation service, and assist in educational programs. But you know, we almost lost that money. Alaskans should know that officials in the Justice Department in Washington wanted to block federal funding to Alaska and two other states because of our liberal marijuana law. Now, that put our delegation in a bit of an awkward position. We didn't want Alaska to lose our share, our fair share of the federal funding. So we fought that proposal and made sure that Alaska did receive its grants. However, at the same time, I personally don't want to suggest that I support the state's marijuana possession law, because I don't. It's a bad law, and it's one that we can hardly be proud of. I remember what Public Safety Commissioner Bob Sundberg said at my drug hearing in Anchorage last year. He testified that our state encourages violations of federal law. I quote, "Only in Alaska can one sit at home and smoke marijuana, secure in the knowledge that you are breaking federal law with the blessings of the state Supreme Court," quote, unquote. Now, no one wants to see a change in our laws that would take away the right of privacy, but the right of a mature individual to exercise free choice is certainly one thing, and pot being pushed on a 9-year-old child is another. Keep in mind, as adults, our overriding responsibility is to set worthy examples to our young people. This is one constituent that would be pleased if you find a way to change, a good way to change our drug law. If in doing so, we have to make a choice between a dubious argument that we endanger certain privacy rights on one hand or the well-being of Alaska's youth on the other, I don't think there's a choice at all. I know that young Alaskans have recognized the double standard. In October, the Alaska Association of School Governments, made up of students from all over Alaska, unanimously adopted a resolution calling for the recriminalization of marijuana. This group felt that the state's marijuana law created a clear double standard that was making the fight against drug abuse in the schools much more difficult. I believe all of us need to listen to the voices of young Alaskans. Drug and alcohol abuse is among the human concerns that we must not forget as we seek to address the economic issues that tend to preoccupy us in times like this. We are really here because Alaskans chose us to be the ones to attack Alaska's problems head on. If we act with strength, with purpose and unity, we will succeed. If we Alaskans can act with the single-minded purpose on the challenges confronting us, the ANWR, the trade opportunities, and the human needs of our citizens, we will prove ourselves worthy of the public trust placed in us. Thank you for inviting me to address you, and with the permission, I would be pleased to take your questions if time remains.
Senator has agreed to take questions from the floor. Senator, Representative Sam Cotton.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome,
Thank
Senator
you, Mikoski. Sam.
On the subject of ANWR, I think that there has been a lot of interest, not only in the legislature, but throughout Alaska. And I think we all recognize that there is a wide range of benefits that might be available to Alaska should that area be open to development. I think it's our responsibility to represent the interests of all people in Alaska. And I was very encouraged by your remarks about the possibility that the state would retain an overriding royalty should any lands be transferred to private ownership. I think that would go a long way toward ensuring fair treatment for Alaska. And I'm wondering if you're willing to support that. I want to ask you a direct question.
Sure.
And find out if, the only way I can see, the only other way to get there from here is for us to concede on the 90-10 split and just assume that we're only going to get 50%. And then we could ask you to try to convince Congress to take that other 40% and use it for the purposes of, say, purchasing some of those refuge lands that other people are interested in.
Thank you, Sam. Well, first of all, I don't want to concede anything, and we're going in to the negotiations on a 90-10 split. But as I pointed out, we need to have flexibility. And as we begin to negotiate from a tactical point of view, make a determination what, if any, of the 90-10 we might have to give to obtain our objective, which is to open ANWR. Now, on the overriding royalty, I'm glad you asked that question because I think it's something that perhaps has been overlooked. The state is the primary dictator, if there is a dictator in this type of an arrangement, because it would be very difficult for the delegation to support a position contrary to the state's wish. In other words, if the legislature and the governor said, hey, we don't want to take a position, we'd have a difficult time, and the corporations that are negotiating on their own and the Department of Interior would have a difficult time doing something that the state felt was contrary to their best interest. So my point is the state has a strong position of leverage on overriding royalty. And as it goes into the negotiations, it can simply say, look, unless we get something that we feel is in our best interest, we're not going to support the process. Now, theoretically, you're saying, well, you know, we would lose the 90-10 by allowing the trades to take place. But you can negotiate from a leverage point of view a position on overriding royalty. It's a matter of saying, okay, you know, to get the state aboard, what do we have to give? And it's quite appropriate that an overriding royalty be part of that consideration. But it's difficult to pinpoint. It's part of the negotiation process, but I would certainly encourage you to consider that. Did that answer in general the frame of questioning that you had in mind?
Well, I don't guess I really need to pin you down too tight, but
I'd support it, yes.
Thank
I'm
you.
Suggesting it.
Senator Rick Ewing.
Thank you. Senator, you talked about a higher tariff on streaming, and maybe you could give us a little bit of an update also on what's going to be happening with the trade deficit and what Congress plans to do with the trade imbalance right now, and with possible decline in dollar if we're going to actually have a better trade situation and one that will not be in a deficit position.
That's a long question. You're going to get a longer answer. I don't support tariffs, and my effort to put the tariff on Surimi is to catch the attention of the Japanese, because there's no justification for them to have a tariff on imported Surimi. And I have a reason to believe that they're going to recognize that and pull their tariff off. The trade legislation is before Congress. It's going to be a priority. It's going to be a very hot and heavy debate, because protectionism comes into the picture, and we have lost markets and market shares all over the world, and there's a great concern about it. But I would prefer to take a tact, and there are several of us who support this concept, of demanding market access in those countries that enjoy full market access in the United States. Now, Congress is not going to stand still for a $70 billion trade deficit with Japan. And that's what we're facing. The total trade deficit in the United States today is about $165 billion. It's pretty hard to expect Korea and Taiwan to get in line when Japan obviously has been able to accumulate this, and it's done so in an extraordinary environment because we have leverage, because we are the best customer of Japan. We are their largest market. The value of having total market access to the United States is what makes Japan such a significant world power. So we're going to relate in the debate process. I think we're going to have to take a stand. The issue has been identified. I think it's Kansai. Kansai is the construction of an airport in Osaka Bay at a cost of $8 billion. It's going to be one of the construction wonders of the world. It's approximately 3 miles out in the bay. It's 2 miles long when it will be built and a half mile wide, and it's going to be built in 90 feet of water, so you get some idea of the magnitude of it. I was over there in December and went out to the site. I was the first American on the site. It happened to be December 7th, but that was strictly by accident. But the point I want to make is that that represents the first of $62 billion worth of public works projects in Japan over the next decade. We've been trying to get involved in that construction project for the last 6 years, haven't made a dent in it, and the point is there is an inequity because Japanese construction firms did $1.8 billion worth of construction in the United States last year. We can't break into the Japanese market. We did an appropriation of about $300 million for military construction on our air bases in Japan. $285 million was done by Japanese contractors. So we're going to retaliate, but we're going to do it in a responsible manner. And some of the things we're considering include an FAA appropriation of $10 billion over the next 10 years to upgrade our airports and air traffic control, and we would preclude those countries that don't allow us access into their markets. That's one particular phase. There's another, a 301, which is an unfair trade filing with the USTR and the Department of Commerce. No member of Congress has ever filed one. You have to be an interested party. I contend that I, as an individual, am an interested party. We have one ready to go. Having a lot of fun watching the administration decide what they're going to do. But we are going to take a stand on the issue in a responsible manner, and I hope it will be towards the issue of encouraging countries to open up their markets so we can compete. But it's a tough set of facts. We've become a debtor nation. First time since the First World War, there's more foreign ownerships in the United States today than there's U.S. ownerships overseas. We're seeing foreigners basically finance our deficit. I was a banker for a while, and I can tell you the power and influence of one who holds another's debt. And it's significant because much of our debt is being financed by foreign investment. And it's important. Nothing wrong with it. We better darn well know what's going on.
Representative Red Boucher, then Senator Sturgeluski.
A historical comment and a question, Senator. We talked about our mounting an effort on ANWR, and I was involved in the pipeline and the D2, and when you indicated that the New York Times was firing its editorial, that usually will be followed by the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune and the Dallas Herald, who said no to everything from statehood on. But one of the things that we found in the D2 battle was that the legislature, ironically, Governor Cooper headed up the D2 Steering Council, and we took a surgical approach to where we went, instead of letting, let's say, Wichita, Kansas, clip the New York Times and fill it in, we took the story of Alaska to individual editorial boards. In fact, I was looking through the file of that the other day, and I found that from Middle America, there was a great response. And when we started out, there was about 110 editorials nationally against Alaska, and we ended up, and there were 404. I think one of the things that might be done here early on is to identify by name and district those members of the House and Senate who are not necessarily opposed but might not have enough information and are relying on the Times and the other people. So I would ask you the question, first of all, do you think a surgical approach like that might be the best approach to take? And secondly, would your office and Congressman Young and Senator Stevens supply this body with the particular states? There may be somebody here from Toledo or what have you that could build that bridge.
Yeah, I think that's very appropriate, and as you recall, during those days, there were weekly meetings held in Washington, and the troops went out and made the specific contacts, and it's going to take that kind of an effort, as you refer to as a surgical effort, to make it happen this time. It's going to take a very sophisticated public relations effort zeroed in to telling the story, to telling the facts, to getting people up to Prudhoe Bay so they can see for themselves. Some of them you're not going to change their minds, but others you are. They're going to be surprised. And, you know, Don Young introduced the House bill because he had to offset Udall's bill, because the psychology of Udall's bill is to close Anwar. So his is to open. Now, in the Senate, we're going to wait. We're going to wait for your input. And it's very important to... You know, we have it within appropriate parameters. And then the process is going to have to be very orderly, and it's going to have to be very effective. And those kind of efforts, pinpointing in specific areas, editorial boards and so forth. If we had an energy crisis in this country, it wouldn't be much of a problem. But we don't, we may, and we will. The question is when.
Senator Sturgiolisky, then Representative Coconut.
Well, yeah, they're trying to break that log jam, Senator, and I have every reason to believe that it will come. As far as where it is now, everybody is going through the agonizing realities that they need the funds released, and the process continues, and I can find out specifically where the legislation is, but I think that it is going to come out, and it is going to be turned loose. And of course, we have a different situation because we've got to have it early for our planning, and we just can't do a lot of the work any time. But fortunately, there are a few other states that share a similar, not quite as severe, strategic location. But I feel confident that the highway legislation will be available in the sense of its application to Alaska in the manner that it has been, because there's always been efforts to change the formula, which would be detrimental to Alaska, and we've been able to maintain the existing formula, and I think we will continue to do that. So I'll find out the specifics of where it is, though.
Senator, there are seven more people requested to ask questions, and after that we'll cut it off. Okay. So Representative Coconin, then Senator Duncan is next. Representative Coconin.
Thank you. Senator, one of the economic questions in regard to Anwar is what is going to happen to the price of Alaskan oil in the American market, especially in view of the continued prohibition to export of North Slope crude. Essentially, the Anwar oil would also go into the same restricted California market, or can we open up the export?
Well, I think from a strategic tactical position to committed to the Anwar issue, which is the challenge before us, and at the same time push for the export of Alaskan oil would be inappropriate. The reason for that is that those who are looking for excuses to oppose Anwar would take that issue and simply say, well, we're going to open up an area and sacrifice the caribou for the benefit of our friendly neighboring nations who are going to receive the oil, and while we may benefit from the standpoint of offsetting the trade imbalance, we're still going to have to buy that like amount of oil from Mexico or Canada, so the trade imbalance argument really doesn't hold water, and you, I think, dampen your argument on ANWR if you have two issues going down the pike at the same time. Furthermore, in spite of some of the thoughts to the contrary, the owners of the oil, namely the three major companies, ARCO, Standard of Alaska, and Exxon, have not yet officially changed their position and promoted the change in the law. They are not against Congress changing the law, but they are not willing to come out and support with an active lobbying effort the change necessary to allow the export of the oil. Now, obviously, when you own something, you have something to say about it. Now, the state owns 1/8 of the oil as royalty oil and has an interest. But they claim a number of specific reasons. Among them, they have long-term contracts for ships in compliance with the Jones Act because half the oil is consumed on the West Coast, the other half moves through the Panama Canal and moves around in smaller ships into the Gulf. Furthermore, those refineries in the Gulf are set up to use the low-sulfur Alaska crude. If you bring in Mexican crude, you have to change over the refineries and so forth. So unless we can get the owner companies behind the effort, it's going to be pretty hard to do, particularly as we go down the stream with ANWR on one side and the export issue on the other. I am committed to it. I think it will happen at some point in time, but it has to be in the economic interests of the owners. And there is a transportation savings, but they claim it's not sufficient enough to offset the impact of moving a significant amount of North Slope oil out and finding another source to bring in, and as a consequence, that's where the issue currently stands. So I've tried to give you briefly as full an answer as I could on
Senator Duncan, then Representative Menard.
Thank you. Senator Murkowski,
well, first of all, let me cover it on a statewide basis, and I've had several meetings with the Coast Guard. I've contacted Admiral Yost. He's contacted me. The overall long-term role and mission of the Coast Guard will be one of expansion in the state of Alaska. They are bringing in another C-130 into Kodiak that will bring about another 30 in support of that. Their plans for Cold Bay and utilization of a facility there would include about 50 additional personnel. There are two ships, one coming into Ketchikan and one coming into Seward, that will be larger than the ships they replace. That doesn't offset the situation here in Juneau. First of all, I think the Coast Guard has not done an adequate job of evaluating the economic efficiencies, and they promised us that information, and they have not given it to us. Now, as a consequence, legislation was introduced over in the House to stop the authorization until such time as we can address the issue in some detail and with reasonable justification. The Coast Guard, again, has promised they're pursuing it. I got a report today with some detail where they attempted to provide us with a specific number of houses that were owned by both civilians and military personnel in Juneau, whether they were married or single. They indicated that they would look at natural attrition initially. They indicated that perhaps they could address those that did not have families initially, and that's all fine and good. It's part of the process. The issue is not cast in concrete, but the cement is being mixed. So as a consequence, I think we have to recognize that the Coast Guard went into this as a consequence of Congress and the public demanding an expanded mission. And what they did is give the Coast Guard a budget that was inadequate to complete the mission. So the Coast Guard looked at ways of increasing efficiencies, and they basically changed the district structure in New York and San Francisco and took something from each district, which is going to get a congressional response, and put the logistics and engineering in San Francisco in New York. And they claim there are efficiencies. Well, there may be. But by the same token, we're not satisfied that they asked for the adequate number of billets necessary to meet the mission expansion of the Coast Guard. And we're going through that process and asking them why they didn't do it. So the issue is still very much alive, but it is a serious issue, and it's certainly serious for Juneau. And I don't want to underestimate it by any means, but we're very much involved in the process, and I would hope that whatever comes down is given in adequate detail to basically support the recommendation currently espoused by the Coast Guard.
Representative Menard and then Representative Taylor.
Thank you. Senator, I want to applaud you on the drug and alcohol issue. Hopefully, we as the Alaska State Legislature can follow through and decriminalize marijuana. My question is, one of the resolutions that we are dealing with in this body is the resolution on a nuclear free Arctic for a nuclear free Alaska. That are coming in to myself and my other colleagues are strongly in favor of this resolution. If we pass this resolution, what would it say to you and the delegation back in Washington?
Well, if you pass the resolution, it's going to say just what the resolution says, and there's an awful lot of misconceptions over the issue of nuclear freeze, what is meant. Is there a reciprocal reaction from the Soviets and others who have nuclear capabilities? Are there other proposals that have merit, such as Bill Down, which reduces the nuclear threat? And so I think whatever your disposition is after you address the issue is an appropriate measure of your evaluation of what kind of a stand you want to take. If every state obviously took that kind of a position, it would eliminate testing, and everybody has an opinion on the merits of testing. Everybody has an opinion on the merits of our national security and what a nuclear capability means to our national security. So I think these are things that you have to reflect on in your debates. On the issue, I briefly saw the telegram that Secretary Shultz, I guess, sent to each of you. I am frankly quite surprised that the resolution would be noted, because it seems to me there's an awful lot of things that happen that, they don't respond to. And as a consequence, I'm going to find out a little bit more about this and why they responded. I think it raises the elevation of the interest, and that's good in one sense. On the other hand, if the state of Alaska takes a position against opposing any nuclear exposure of any kind, that puts some significant military considerations in, because we have certain military capabilities off our coast. We have certain military capabilities in certain areas of our state from time to time, and the effect of that and the responsibility of the federal government on the Constitution, which is the safety of the populace. These all come into part of the agonization of addressing the issue, and I wish you good luck.
Representative Taylor, then Representative Davidson.
Thank you. I would also like to thank you, Senator, for your candid comments and the answers that you've made today to this body. They've been fascinating, and I really appreciate that, and also your strong support for the private sector indicated in your speech. I would, however, like to ask, what can you do on the national level to remove some of the foundations and bases for this intricate and involved permitting process that we are now embroiled in? Most of the permits that you were discussing, both for the coal production and also our mineral production in this state, are based upon a state reaction to federal law, where we have implemented here, through the legislative process, a duplicate system of laws that, as you know, has to be either the same as or more strict than federal law. How can we, working with you, eliminate some of these processes and get the private sector in Alaska moving again?
Thanks, Robin. Well, I wouldn't agree with you entirely. I think that in some instances, Alaska has gone beyond federal law. For example, EPA water quality is an issue that has been debated among many of you for an extended period of time, and there's a certain group from the private sector that feels pretty strongly about what position the state should take. The state has an option there. Most states have taken over, and you know, that's your call, and I'm sure that you'd find EPA most willing to relinquish not their overall responsibility to see the state meets the federal guidelines, but to take over the response, because you know a lot more about placer mining than somebody out of Washington, D.C. What we do in Washington on the permitting process, and it's unfortunate, but we do it, is we take them by the hand and lead them through the agencies. It's a tiresome but a successful process, because you just can't change the system, but you can say, all right, what do you need next? All right, and if they know that we're there and going to outsit them, they have a tendency to begin to move the process. And I think that the state can be a little more direct, because you know you're here, you're cohesive, and Ted, Don, and I do an awful lot of that. We just take them by the hand and walk through the agencies, and pretty soon they know that we're going to show up. We spend an awful lot of time with the Forest Service at one agency.
Representative Davidson, then Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam President. Senator, and thank you for your words and the comments that you had to bring before us. We appreciate your remarks. My question is on the matter of land exchanges in ANWR. I feel that we have a special obligation to acknowledge and protect the land and the native people of the state of Alaska and their relationship to that land. And if we use the yardstick, the land exchange is good. If it is good for your children's grandchildren, would you please comment on the land exchanges in that context?
Well, I think you almost have to go back and identify what we know and we don't know. All the exchanges are proposed, but we have an idea. And let's take the Koniag, which has received a good deal of notoriety, and most people are generally aware of the area. And my understanding is it was selected by Koniag. It is a bear habitat that has a great significance from the standpoint of fish and wildlife management of the Kodiak brown bear resource. And the wisdom of the native people within Koniag communicated to us is that they are willing to put up a portion of that for the right to take a risk or a position in ANWR. Now, I think this process needs a little greater examination, because in the risk process, what happens if there's no oil? Is the Department of Interior simply going to say, well, here's your land back? The Department of Interior's obligation is to the Federal Treasury in the sense that there is allegedly a resource there. If it's put up for a cash bid and there's no oil, you don't get your cash back. So, you know, these are concerns that I'm sharing with you that I think deserve your examination and certainly the examination of any private corporation, native corporation, that would propose an exchange. Because, you know, there was one proposal suggested that, well, if we don't get oil, we're going to give the land back. Well, the Department of Interior isn't going to accept that. Now, there are other alternatives, and the negotiation process can start, but by the same token, there's certainly a risk in this kind of a game because, you know, you usually don't find oil. You remember we're going to look for oil off Seward, we're going to look for oil off Yakutat, and it speaks for itself. So,
Representative Martin.
Chairman, Senator Kalski, I too want to thank you very much for acknowledging the wisdom of our youth in Alaska.
Thank you.
I'm sure that to be really proud to know that someone's listening, even if you may be in Washington, and maybe send you from your message back to Alaska legislators here may listen. Also, I want to bring up another question that was previously talked about, and that is the ballot question of a nuclear disarmament and nuclear-free Alaska. And I feel we owe it to you to give you more information, which I will do, because the resolution has to do with the nuclear-free Alaska. And you touched upon that while we talk about other sources of energy. And so if this caught you off guard, and I'll give you that information.
Well, I'm not trying to duck the question, but when you consider a nuclear-free Alaska, and you're also considering a responsibility to the national security of our nation, you have to include all the appropriate aspects or else ignore them. Because, you know, we do have nuclear submarines, and it's no secret that they're in various vicinities at different times. We have other military capabilities in Alaska that are significant. We don't talk about them for obvious reasons. So, you know, you're either... It's like a situation that I guess only our neighbors in Japan can handle this, but law says in Japan that they're required to inquire as to whether any ship coming into a Japanese port carries a nuclear device. And they inquire, and we say we never give an answer to that question. But see, they've asked, and that's the extent of their technical obligation, so that's how it's handled. So, good luck.
Last question, Senator. Representative Barnes.
Thank you. Senator Murkowski, I'd like to say that I very much appreciate your remarks on drug abuse in our youth. And in that vein, I know that you've held hearings in Alaska on drug abuse. I don't know that you're aware of the context of the Raven decision, which held that marijuana smoking could be recriminalized if it was a hazard to our health by the legislature. And I would like to know if in your hearings that you do not believe that there's enough evidence to suggest that the smoking of marijuana is a hazard to your health.
Our hearings, Representative Barnes, didn't get into that area. Got into primarily overall drug use in Alaska and the significance of what the threat means. And I would have to defer any resolve of just what the health hazards are to appropriate experts, and I'm sure you're going to find a wide variety of views on the issue. I think it's fair to say that there is becoming enough historical evidence now that certain conclusions are attempting to be drawn, and I could just leave you with that, because if you do take it up and debate it, obviously that is a major factor in your consideration. I just happen to believe that I'll stand on the rights of privacy, but when it comes to a higher cause, it's just my inclination that the youth of Alaska are a higher cause and are entitled to every possible support. And I'm willing to give up my individual right of privacy in that sense for the youth if indeed it will help the cause of reducing the drug problem and the drug threat in our state.
Senator, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Senator Halford.
President, the Senate will reconvene in our chambers for adjournment. At this time, I move and ask you to consent to the joint session standing adjourned.
Without objection, the joint session will now stand be adjourned. Thank you.
Would the House stand at ease while the chamber is being cleared?
We've got to do something about this chair.
Order. Before the at ease, we were under special orders. Is there any further special orders? Representative Taylor.
Briefly, I ask permission of the chair to and the body to speak on the issue of permanent fund investment policy.
Do I hear any objections? Hearing none, proceed, Representative.
The Permanent Fund Board recently met this last week, and one of the recommendations coming out of that board was a request to this body to amend their policy of investment so as to allow them, Mr. Speaker, to invest in what they called international securities. I'd like to examine with you for just a moment what that is really saying. Now, their mission is to get the highest and best gain they can from the permanent fund monies. And they have wisely invested that. And I applaud them for it. That what they are requesting now, however, is to take Alaskan permanent fund monies and place them at risk in international corporations. And I ask you, does this mean that if the yield is high enough and the price looks good, will they be investing in South African corporations who'll be producing paper pulp in direct competition with the Alaskan timber industry of Southeast? Will they be investing in Japanese surimi plants so that they can import surimi in direct competition with Alaskan fishermen? I think they will, if the money's high enough, because that's their goal and their mission. Isn't that a tragedy? That they are now looking to foreign investment. I seriously believe they will be investing in Japanese automobile manufacturing firms so we can put more people out of work in Detroit. And it's probably not wrong for them to do so, because that way they'll make more money for our fund. What happened to Alaska in this process? What in the world is wrong with us as a legislature, Mr. Speaker, allowing that permanent fund board to use their wisdom, to use their investment expertise, to invest those $8 billion first in Alaska, to invest in our mineral industry, to invest in our timber industry, to invest in our fisheries industry, the three basic industries that helped build this building long before big oil ever came along. Maybe then we'll see a private sector and a private economy have the vitality and energy that it had before we imposed all of the burdens that the senator and I were discussing earlier today. I call upon you and this body to join together, and let's devise a slight modification to allow that board the freedom to, and maybe the incentive and the direction, to invest first in Alaska, and let's get Alaska's economy back on the line by using our own savings account to do so. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Any further special orders? Mr. Majority Leader.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that we move up the calendar to general announcements.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, proceed, Representative.
I'd like to announce that the Rail Belt Democratic Caucus will be meeting at 12:30, time to get lunch and then down into the Labor and Commerce Committee room. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that the House stand in adjournment until 11 a.m. Monday.
11 a.m. Monday.